Alrighty, well, I'll begin. I've done a few video presentations before, but not one where I've got only a few people in here and people all over the US. Anyway, my name's Eddie Snell. I'm a member of the Houtman Woodward Medical Research Institute. And I'm going to talk a little bit about x-rays. If I find the page down here. Okay, basically this is the electromagnetic spectrum here. It goes all the way from radio waves to microwaves to infrared to the visible to the ultraviolet to x-rays and gamma rays. And underneath the electromagnetic spectrum, you can get an idea of the size of all those waves. So buildings are about on the same length scale as radio waves. Humans and butterflies are about the same length scale as microwaves. Doing needle points is about the same length scale as infrared. Cells are about the same length scale as visible light. And then as you get down to molecules, you're into the ultraviolet and atoms are into the x-rays. And that poses a problem for us, because if we want to look at anything that is the size of a molecule, if we want to understand how biology works, we have to use things that are smaller than visible light. We can't use a microscope to image a protein in the body. And that's why we use x-rays. Now this is Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen. He was alive from 1845 to 1923, and he's basically the person that discovered x-rays. They're electromagnetic radiation. They are about from 100 angstrom to 0.01 angstrom. An angstrom is a very strange unit, it's a historical unit, but it's about 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, or about 4 billionths of an inch. The shorter the wavelength for the x-ray, the greater its energy and penetrating power. And a mixture of different wavelengths is known as white x-rays as opposed to monochromatic x-rays that represent only a single wavelength. This is probably the classic picture of the x-rays. It's a picture of a hand with a ring on. And Wilhelm, as I say, introduced them in, or was around till 1923. The science itself, about 150 years since x-rays were discovered, about 100 years since crystallography was discovered. In the laboratory, we make x-rays from different metals or different elements, sorry. There's molybdenum, copper, cobalt, iron, and chromium. And for any of these metals, there is a characteristic wavelength. And this is the wavelength here for copper. It's 1.542 angstrom. And the way we produce them is through a rotating anode or an anode. Now, this has the metal here. In this particular case, this is copper. And we have a filament that's in front of here, and the filament fires electrons onto the copper. As the electrons hit the copper, they give out x-rays, and x-rays come off from all sorts of different directions. Now, we want to make the x-rays as powerful as possible. And to do that, our filament, almost like a light bulb filament, has to be very powerful. It fires a lot of electrons here that hit the copper. The copper heats up. And the reason that we call this a rotating anode is because to stop the copper melting, this actually rotates. So there's always fresh copper that's in the beam, in the electron beam. And inside here, we put cold water in to cool it and stop it from melting. And this is your typical lab x-ray generator that's sitting here. It's the big green box in the bottom there, and the stuff on the top is where we actually put the crystals. Now, I mentioned the word crystals. Because we can't image individual proteins with light, we have to use diffraction properties. And for diffraction properties, you needed to order the ray of an object to actually be able to see it. And we make that order the ray through growing a crystal. And it's very, very simple to explain how a crystal is grown. We have some function of a precipitant concentration and some function of a macromolecule concentration. And once we've got the protein in solution, if the precipitant is low, the protein is soluble and nothing happens. If the precipitant concentration is very high, it's up in that precipitation zone, and the protein drops out of solution. Now, what we want to do is we want to get our experiment so that the protein goes into that part of the diagram labeled the nucleation zone. If we go into the nucleation zone, that's where molecules of the protein start coming together in an ordered array. And then as molecules of the protein start coming together, the macromolecule concentration in solution decreases, and we drop down into the metastable zone. A metastable zone is just another word for something that is very nice for the crystal to grow. So if we can get this nucleus of molecules together and we pull them down into this metastable zone, we start growing a crystal. And that's basically how we grow a crystal. We settle somewhere between a clear solution and a precipitated solution, we find a nucleation zone, and then we nucleate the crystal and bring it down into the metastable zone and grow it. That sounds very simple, but it's actually very difficult to do, and we do a lot of experimentation, which I'm sure will be discussed in another talk. There are many different ways of growing a crystal. The first way is microbatch. And in microbatch, you just start in an initial condition here, and you wait to see what happens. If the protein comes out of solution and starts growing a crystal, you go down here into the metastable zone, and your crystal grows larger. Another technique is vapor diffusion. And in vapor diffusion, you have a reservoir which has a concentrated solution, and you have a protein solution that either hangs over it or sits above it. And what happens is the concentrated solution pulls water out of the solution that has the protein in. As water is pulled out, the macromolecule concentration increases. This is the macromolecule concentration increasing in that direction. And the precipitant concentration increases. And you go along this trajectory here, where you pass through the metastable zone, you reach the nucleation zone. That's where the protein starts coming out of solution. And you go into the metastable zone and grow. So batch and vapor diffusion are the two main types of crystallization. There's also dialysis crystallization, which is just a slightly different trajectory. And this is what you hope to get. This is a crystal. Now the crystal, to give you an idea of the size of it, sits on that little plinth that's at the very end of where everything is centered on in the corner there. And you can see a picture of it in the microscope here. So crystals are actually pretty small when you get them. And this is what you get. It's a diffraction pattern from them. I'll show you a little blow up of that in a second. And this is what the diffraction pattern looks like. Now, you see how we've got all these spots here? Each one of these spots, or the position of each one of these spots, relates to the position of an atom within that protein that makes the crystal up. And the intensity of each one of those spots relates to the identity of that atom that's in there. And that's a very, very simple way of explaining this. To give you an idea that's a little more complex than that, that was the subject of a Nobel Prize. So it's not quite as simple as that, but position of the spot is related to position of the atoms, intensity of the spot is related to what those atoms are. This is what the X-ray data gives you. It's electron density, so you have a model here, and this is your electron density around it. We've not modeled the hydrogens in here, but this is what they look like when you look at the experimental data. And what we're interested in is making the experimental data as strong as possible. So this is a synchrotron. It's the Crab Nebula. It's about 6,500 light years away, and it's another source of X-rays. Now, we've actually built these on the ground, and this is how they operate. You have an electron gun, which fires into a storage ring. And within that storage ring, there's a little radio station that basically gives those electrons a little bit more power. Once the electrons get a lot of power, they're released into this large ring here. Now, the electrons travel around the ring, and they're steered by magnets. And the electron has a lot of power, but it's slowing down as it goes around. And as it slows down, it gives off radiation. Part of that radiation is X-rays. So the magnet steers the electron around, but X-rays are electromagnetic radiation. They have no magnetic moment, and they're not affected by the magnets here, so they go straight on. And that's where you get synchrotron radiation from. This is a source of X-rays. To give you an idea how powerful synchrotron radiation is, this is a light bulb here, and this is power, and this is a log scale. This is about your dentist's X-ray here. So it's about the same kind of amount of X-rays as you get from the sun. And you get to synchrotrons, and they are about 10 to the 10 times as powerful as the X-rays that you get in the dentist. So they're extremely strong X-rays. If we look at a synchrotron, this is the advanced photon source in Argonne National Lab. It has the linear accelerator, it has the booster ring, and then it has the synchrotron itself here. And then these little triangular things that you see here are all little experimental stations where you've got X-rays or different types of radiation that are coming off around here. And this is the kind of instrument that we use for doing data collection on a lot of these crystals. There's a beam line coming off right there. Now, they're all over the place. We're in Buffalo. The synchrotron sources all over the US. There's synchrotron sources all over the world. And I'm not going to go into the neutron sources, but we also use neutrons as well. Now, I want to make an analogy here to a synchrotron, because I'm going to introduce you to a new technology that this BioXFEL program is about. But a candle provides light, and more candles provide more light. That's called evolutionary technology. Essentially, you've got one candle and you've evolved it by expanding that technology to make it better. A light bulb also provides light, but a light bulb is very different from a candle. It's an example of a revolutionary technology. And it changed the way we do things. So here's the graph I showed before about the power of the X-rays. And if you remember that we want more powerful X-rays, because the more powerful the X-ray, the more detail we can see, the more understanding that we get of what the protein looks like. So this is the graph associated with synchrotrons. And there's a new development called the X-ray free electron laser. And the X-ray free electron laser is about there, right at the top of the page. That's a laser in the background there. But to show you where we are, this was the previous graph I showed you here with the synchrotrons, which are up to about 10 to the 25 in terms of their intensity. The X-ray laser is right up there at about 10 to the 31 to 10 to the 33. So it's another order of, or several orders of magnitude in terms of intensity. So it makes a big difference in how we do things. They're revolutionary sources of radiation. And this is one of the X-ray free electron lasers. This is in operation at the moment. This is in Stanford. This is where the experiments are done down here, and the experiments are done down there. And this long line that you see up there is basically the laser itself. So it's a little bit bigger than a laser pointer that you might use. You can read this when you look at the presentation. I won't go into it, but it's how X-rays are actually produced by the electron as it goes round and changes direction because of a magnetic field. But the first thing we do for the X-ray laser is we have a source of electrons. Now, in the rotating anode, I mentioned the filament. This is the kind of filament that we have inside an X-ray laser. It's an electron injector, and it produces it's a highly polished copper plate where there's a short burst of light from a laser hits it. That basically initiates an electron to be released from it, and you get one electron for every 100,000 photons that hit it. So that's the first part of the X-ray laser. And that sits down there. It's not quite at the end, because this X-ray laser is using an old instrument, and it's about two-thirds of the way down where the injector is. The electrons that are produced are then accelerated, and this is one of the little, it's like a radio station that accelerates them. It gives the electrons a lot more energy. Shows some people to scale there to see what size it is. That's where that sits. And then they're steered. And this is a magnet here. It's got four poles on. This basically steers the electrons down to this long, straight lasing system. And that sits there. And it's actually steering several places down this line here. It's not just in that one place. And then finally, what you've got is what's called an undulator. Now, an undulator looks kind of complex, but it's actually a fairly simple instrument. It's a series of north, south, north, south, north, south magnets. And as the electrons come in, they wiggle. And as they change direction, they emit radiation. So each time the direction changes, there's radiation emitted. So you get these little bursts of radiation that are emitted. And those bursts of radiation all come together in a coherent manner. And this is what this undulator looks like. This is in the tunnel at LCLS. And this is basically this long straight section after the steering is where that undulator is. And this is what happens. As at first, it's sort of a random, your electrons are in random bunches. But what happens is all the peaks and all the troughs start to interfere with each other. I don't know if you've seen these headphones that you put on when you're on a plane or something like that, that make everything silent. What those headphones are doing is they're taking in noise that's in a waveform, and they're applying an opposite waveform. When you add those two together, when you get a peak and a trough, they become zero. But what happens in a laser is all these peaks, where the peaks coincide, they start to add up. and you get these peaks of X-ray wavelengths. And these peaks, as you go further along the undulator, start to group into very, very short bursts of electrons. And they're very intense, they're very short, and that's what makes them so exciting. Now, the other thing is the pulse length of these is on the order of about 10 to 20, maybe 30 femtoseconds. This is what happens to a protein when you shoot them with one of these lasers. The pulse comes in. After about 5 femtoseconds, you can start to see some of the atoms coming off. After about 10 femtoseconds, even more atoms are coming off. After about 20 femtoseconds, a lot of them are coming off. And after about 50, the whole thing disintegrates. What's happening is the X-ray intensity is so intense that you're getting a Coulomb charge repulsion. Every molecule that was normally together within this protein suddenly does not want to be next to the other molecule, and the whole thing explodes. The nice thing about this, though, is the speed of light is a lot faster than this. So the X-ray data that you get has already come from this molecule before this destruction actually takes place. So what we do is, in this new X-ray source, we fire crystals in, or we ablate crystals. We destroy the crystal, but the data is already produced before the destruction occurs. Now, it's really exciting, because if we look at some length scales here, so we've got the length scales in the vertical axis, and it's on a log scale again, and we look at some time scales, and the time scales are along here, along this horizontal axis, we can start to see some of the things that we can look at. So X-ray crystallography is a very good technique for looking at the detail of macromolecular structure, but it's really only good for things that are static. And the reason for that is you build up a complete data set over a series of orientations of the crystal. And also there's billions of molecules within that crystal, so you're averaging not only over space but over time, so you can't really see anything that's dynamic. There's lots of other techniques that you can use, FRET, NMR, molecular dynamics, that's computational, but there are problems with those techniques. They're either limited by size, they're limited by information, or they're limited because you might be incorrect with the molecular dynamics. Now, there's many processes which, well, all biological processes are not static. You have protein translation, which takes on the order of a second. There's transport, which is less than a second. There's side chain flips going on. There's domain motions. There's proton transfer. All of these things here are associated with mechanisms in biology, function and mechanism. So if we could see them and understand them structurally and see some of this going on, we have a lot more knowledge about how those work. And the exciting thing about the X-ray laser is, once you've got the kind of intensity that the X-ray laser had, and you've got it on the order of a femtosecond, all this area here, all these possibilities of what you want to look at, they're opened up. And that's where I'm going to leave my talk, just to show you why we're excited about this X-ray laser technology. And I think Dan is going to talk a little bit about what structural biology gives you for that kind of information. Okay, Dan?